My name is Stacy Speedlin, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Stacy.
My sobriety date is April the 25th of 2003. Okay. As a member of my home group says, I'm as grateful as I know how to be for the time I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. What a gift. I'm so excited to be here. Jody, thank you so much. I got a Facebook message from Jody asking me to come and talk here. She contacted me in April and said that the speaker you were supposed to have had to cancel, so they needed a female speaker. And she said, would you be willing to come down? And all she gave me was the dates. And I said, well, yeah, I'm available. I'd be honored to come. And she said, great, we'll have someone call you and give you all the particulars and get you here. So sometime last month, I get a call from Tom, who tells me that this is a motorcycle rally. And I said, what? See, and I'm so glad that y'all prepare people before they get here, because I would have worn a suit and embarrassed myself all weekend. You know, I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous to show my respect for the podium, to come here, and to show my respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe your speaker, Kenny, yesterday said that the outward appearance should match the inward reality. The inward reality is that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I am proud of the work that you've done in my life. My mother is happy. San Antonio Police Department is happy. There's a lot of people out there that I'm not causing trouble for anymore. So I thank you for giving me the opportunity to come here. And it's always interesting to me. I seem to get in a lot of trouble in conferences. This time I ended up showing my amateur side, getting a burn on my leg from the motorcycle, which I only rode for less than 5 minutes. A couple of years back, I was speaking in Lufkin, Texas, and I come from the concrete jungle. I come from a big city, San Antonio, seventh largest city in the country, and there are things I've never seen before, like all this corn and stuff is a little overwhelming for me this weekend. But, you know, I don't get to see things like that where I come from. And so I rode to Lufkin, Texas to give a talk with a good friend of mine in Al-Anon, Becky F. And, you know, they like to mess with me because I'm not from the country. So they tell me all kinds of stuff that's not true. And when we were riding through, there were a bunch of pastures of cows, kind of like you have this weekend. And Becky told me, she said, you know, pay attention to how the cows are sitting. Because if they're hunkered down, that means it's going to rain. So I'm excited about this. I'm watching the pastures of cows. And we drove by, and about half of them were sitting down. And I said, well, what does that mean? They said, oh, that's a 50% chance of rain. So, you know, I'm having a good time. And I go to Lufkin. I'm the Saturday night speaker. So I go outside to get what we call in Texas prayed up, and I go out there, and this old boy comes out, and he says, you know, I wonder if it's going to rain. I said, oh, well, actually, it's a 50% chance of rain. And he said, well, how do you know that? I said, because half the cows were hunkered down this morning. And he looked at me with this insane look, and he said, they're not hunkered down because it's going to rain, little lady. They're hunkered down because they're tired. What is wrong with you? And I said, I don't know, I'm just here to give a talk, that's all. You know. So if you think you've got an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous behind this podium, I need to tell you that is not the case. I come to these functions and I agree to go to any length for my sobriety because I believe that of and by myself, if I separate myself from the pack, for me to drink is to die. And I don't ever want to live the way I was living ever, ever again. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Some people come here with a life. And as a result of getting drunk and burning that to the ground or having some trouble, they come into Alcoholics Anonymous, they get a chip, and they return back to that good life. I didn't have a life when I came here. There was no life to speak of when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. There was nothing good going on in my life. I didn't have morals when I got here. I developed them over time with good sponsorship. My sponsor is Sharon C. from Los Angeles. I am very adequately sponsored. I'm on a short leash. That's the way it needs to be. And my home group is the Tuesday night Big Book Study in San Antonio. If ever you're in San Antonio on a Tuesday night, please come. Let me know that you are there. It would be an honor to take you around my city. I've been coming to these things long enough to have friends here. My friends Sid and Kelly, my friends Joe and Debbie, all the people that I've gotten to see throughout the course of my recovery. Life is good and it is in full session. And you know, yesterday I got to go with some of the other speakers. We went to that ag breakfast and I saw a cow being bottle fed. It was a baby cow. What do they call? Okay. Whatever it is. And not only that, they had eggs that came from real chickens. I was really excited. You know, I buy my stuff from the store. I've never had something that came directly from the source, you know. So I felt like I had a good connection. You know, it was a good deal. I've had a wonderful time. Friend of mine always says, you're in the middle of a miracle, sometimes you can't see the edges, and that's how it's been this weekend. I've talked to a lot of you, and I'm going to have to get away from this weekend so I can understand the capacity of what I've been through. You know, life is certainly understood backwards, but, you know, I don't know why I'm alcoholic. I thought I had to know. I thought, you know, there's got to be a reason why I'm so screwy. The only thing I can attest for is that I'm an adopted child, hence the last name. I was given up for adoption in the hospital. I was born to a Hispanic mother and a Persian father. I don't know a lot about my history. I'm still learning things about my story today. What I do know is, for reasons that I am not aware of, my father did not want my mother raising me, and he was not an American citizen, and so he was afraid that he couldn't take her from me. He thought one day he'd get deported and I'd end up in foster care. So they made a decision when I was born to give me up for adoption. I stayed in foster care for a very short time, and was adopted by the people that I call my parents today. My parents are good people, people that raised me. Come from the Midwest. My mother's from Steubenville, Ohio. My father is from Lincoln, Nebraska, went to Nebraska State University. Go Big Red, baby! I've been wanting to meet y'all all weekend, you know that? I grew up with the red flags all over the house, all my life. Now, for the rest of y'all, I'm sorry. I know you've already got a resentment, you know, but I love Nebraska Cornhuskers. I do. Love it. My parents are good people. I went to good schools. My mother grew up in alcoholism. I know from being around y'all long enough that alcohol, when you grow up in alcoholism, it doesn't leave room for love. My mom made a decision, I believe, that when she had children of her own, she was going to tell us that she loved us and she was going to show us that she loved us. I grew up in a home where I was told often that I was loved. Anything that I wanted, anything I needed, I was given. My mother is my best friend today, a beautiful, beautiful woman, wonderful woman. But, you know, I'm not blaming alcoholism on that. I need to tell you that, you know, 'cause my parents, my biological parents, when they gave me up for adoption, they told my family that I had died at birth. Now, that has nothing to do with alcoholism. I know today that alcoholism has nothing to do with anything outside of me. But I have this thing called alcoholic perception. I don't see things right. The fact of the matter is, I was given an opportunity to live with a family that could provide everything for me that my real family could not. The feeling was that I had been thrown away by the people who should have loved me the most, and I didn't know what I had done wrong. Now, I carried that kind of alcoholic perception throughout my life. It is all about me. Nobody knows it. My first sponsor used to say, it's like it's your parade, you're not even in it. I hate that. You know, I've always felt that way. Where's mine? When am I going to get mine? I don't know where I got that from. It has nothing to do with the way I was raised. And, you know, I set up the relationship with alcohol when I was 12 years old. I had been restless, irritable, discontent for a while. Things were not going well. I was lying a lot. That was my first tool for living. I lied to all my friends. You know, I was trying to run the world. I was exhausted. I was thirsty. And I got into my parents' liquor cabinet at 12 years old, and I got enough alcohol and took it to middle school with me, had my first drink and my first drunk simultaneously, because like in Texas, I believe in getting it done. And when I put enough of that alcohol into my system, I had a profound reaction to my outlook on life. It changed everything just like that. You know, people, you've heard speakers talk about this a lot. You know, when I got enough of that alcohol in my body, I began to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I did not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I could comprehend the word serenity, and girl, I looked good, you know. I know this is going to sound strange in the Midwest, but I did not want to be Hispanic and Persian. I wanted to be something exotic. You know, I don't know what that is. But I just want to look exotic, you know. Out here I do, but, you know. I never wanted to be what I was, you know. And alcohol didn't make my big parts small. It didn't make my small parts big. It just made it not matter, you know. When I drink alcohol, I find that spiritual mountaintop of whatever. Kind of like what we do with the third step, you know, it's just whatever, whatever. You know, I lost that job. Well, I didn't like it anyway. How about that? You know, the boyfriend left. Okay, well, I didn't even like him either. You know, I want life to not matter. I want to be able to deal with anything that life throws at me and for it to not matter. And alcohol did that for me. And when you find something that works as beautiful as alcohol does, when it flips that switch in your head, I don't know about you, but I'm on. I mean, I want to do that for as long as I could, as hard as I could, and I did. I pursued alcohol to the gates of insanity and almost death. Now, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 25 years old. It was time. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the professionals were telling me if I kept going, I would have been dead within a year, and I believed them. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been arrested several times. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you've been arrested more than three times, all you have to say is several. I've been arrested several times. I've also been institutionalized several times, just so we're clear. It's been a long, dark road before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The first time I ever got institutionalized, I was 12 years old. Had a nervous breakdown. No correlation with drinking. I was just not doing so well, and, you know, they put you away. And back then, they put you away for a while. I got into the institution when I was 12. I got out at 14. They let me out of that institution in the summer of my 14th year, and that August I started high school, and it wasn't a drug rehab, just so we're clear. It was an institution. I didn't have a belt. I didn't have shoelaces. I was on medication, shuffling around for 18 months. But when I got out of that institution and I started high school, they got my transcripts from this mental institution, and they didn't know what to do with a little budding alcoholic of my type. It was an interesting time in history. It was No Child Left Behind. What that means is that they have to graduate you. They just don't know how they're going to do it. So they stuck me in this program in high school called the Challenger Program, and it was for gang members and pregnant teenagers. Now, I was neither one, but they stuck me in there to kind of figure out what to do with me. And they made an exception for me. They gave me this wooden hall pass. I said, pass, you know. And they said, now, anytime you feel like you're going to freak out, show the pass to the teacher, and they'll let you go. No questions asked, right? Now, that is a great thing when you're practicing alcoholism in high school, right? I'd be sitting in school, and all of a sudden, my drink alarm would go off, and I'd just show them the pass. I got to go. Now, I go back behind the dumpsters with my buddies, smoking all that outside issues, having a good time, dropping some of that stuff. You know, it took me a long time in sobriety to learn there were no helicopters flying over my high school. Who knew? But eventually they got onto my little deal, because I wasn't supposed to be just running out of the school. I was supposed to be checking in with this counselor. I've been talking about this lady a lot because she was an unlikely angel in my life. It's an amends that I still owe. So if anybody knows her, her name was Lorraine Grant. She was a guidance counselor in San Antonio at Robert E. Lee High School. I need to make this right. I would go into her office, and by this time in my life, I'm hiding behind a wall of sarcasm and condescending remarks. I got nothing for you. And she tried desperately to talk to me like people do, you know, tried to reach in and help me a little bit. And I remember she tried to talk to me about my relationship with my mom, and I would say these really inappropriate things. Like I'd say, well, you know, I'm thinking about killing her and burying her in the backyard. What do you think? You know, I dressed in all black. I had combat boots. I had a mohawk. I was not a vision for you. So they got a little tired of my fiasco, you know, and after some time, I was approached by the administration of that high school, and they said, look, if you will get a job, show us your paycheck stubs, we will graduate you from high school. So I got a little job, and I showed them my paycheck stubs for a couple of years, and they graduated me from high school with a sixth grade education. And, you know, time's just moving on. I got accepted to a college. I was accepted to Kansas City Art Institute in Kansas City, Missouri. For anybody that's in the art world, that is a very big honor. They accepted me on my portfolio. It was not my transcripts. And I was given a scholarship and allowed to go out to higher learning. Now, if ever there was a time when straightening up and flying right would have been the time, if ever I could have made a decision that I was not going to burn my life to the ground, I wish I would have done it here. I used to sit on that campus and I would see these students from Thailand and England, and some of the top prodigies of the nation were allowed to go to that school. And when I would walk around that campus, I felt so privileged to be a student at Kansas City Art Institute. But y'all know what happens. When I take a drink, I can't predict what's going to happen. And I would go out and I would take a drink and I would not be able to determine how to conduct myself like a student at Kansas City Art Institute. And so they pulled my scholarship and I was sent home within the first semester. And I came home from school and my parents asked me what happened. I said, I made a mistake. I drank too much. I won't behave like that again. No clue that I'm in trouble with alcohol. So I got home from school. Now I'm 17 years old at this point, and I got no money. I got I got no direction going on. I don't know what I'm going to do with myself, you know. And so I got a fake ID and I got into the topless bar industry. I got in at 17. I got out at 25. I got sober at 25. Give you a little picture of who walked in when I came in the rooms. I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous, you did not expect me to clean up my mouth, dress appropriately, or act well for me to sit in your rooms, because that was not something I could do for a very long time. I was a complete mess. And I won't talk about that business. I know there are women that work in that business that do the right things. They feed their kids, they go to college, they come home at night. What I'm going to tell you is I'm just not that kind of woman. I'm an alcoholic. I wreck shop. You give me a little bit of money or a little bit of power and I will become a tornado roaring through the lives of others. We talk about those seven things in the third column of the fourth step: self-esteem, pride, ambitions, personal relations, sex relations. In the beginning, that business catered to all of those things. Like Bill Wilson says in his story, I felt like I had arrived. I was a 17-year-old kid with a six-figure income and I felt you could not touch me. But in the end of my drinking, not the business, but I robbed me of every bit of dignity and self-respect that I had as a woman. Because when alcohol will ask for my dignity, I will give that too, no questions asked. It just got dark and crazy and weird out there, you know? I tell a few stories behind this podium because I like them. You know, I do believe we don't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I do love the fact that I have lived two lives in one lifetime, but it was painful when I got here, let me tell you. I felt like I couldn't take a breath, and I didn't want anybody to know where I had been. But it got dark and weird. You know, I'm a little bit of a hostage taker by trade. Any other hostage takers this weekend? I know y'all are hostage. I've seen y'all. I've been paying attention this weekend. If you're in training for hostage taking, let me tell you what you need to do. You need to find people that you have things in common with, you know? Because if you're looking for a soulmate, you got to find someone who has things, you know, traits like you. You know, like I like chocolate ice cream. He likes chocolate ice cream. We go together. You know what I mean? That's just how I do it. You know, so I was working at the club, and I met this old boy. And we talked for 30 minutes, and that went well. You know, so I already knew we were going to be married. I mean, I was clear. I just knew he was my man. And after talking to him for a little bit, I found out some things about him. What I found out is he talked like I did, he drank like I did, he lied like I did. What do you do with a diamond like that? You get your hands on him? You don't want any of your girlfriends to get him. So, you know, I got my claws in that old boy right away. And we moved in together and set up housekeeping. You can let your imagination go as far as you want to about what two actively drinking alcoholics living together looks like. A friend of mine said it best. Our love was so big, we had to take it outside. You know, we had that good love. We had that real love. You know, Christmas time, we're screaming at each other. I think one time we threw the Christmas tree out the front door. I kid you not. I hate you. I hate you. You know, we were ugly to each other. The only reason we stayed together as long as we did is both of us said that we were going to leave each other once we sobered up. This didn't happen for a long time. It happened for me. It never happened for him. And the reason that relationship ended is because when I was 21 years old, I found out that I was pregnant. I know that when most women find out they're pregnant, they feel the movement of the baby in their stomach and they're excited, they're happy. That was not my experience. I had a few things going on at that time. Number one, I knew I couldn't stay sober for 9 months and I couldn't stay off those outside issues. Number two, I didn't want any child to have a mother like me and I didn't know what to do about that. Well, nobody deserves a woman like me as a mother, you know? And I saw that child as a trap. I saw that baby as doing things to me that I didn't want. I didn't want it to ruin my body, which I thought was the only thing that made me worthwhile in this world. made me money. And I thought it was going to trap me with a man that I hated. I hated him. I knew he was the problem. He did other stuff. I mean, I did some outside issues, but he did some way other stuff. I knew he was the problem, and I hated him, and I felt sorry for myself. And I made a decision that I was not going to have that child. And at that point, he was done with me, and he left me. And I thought to myself, oh, good, you know, the problem has been removed. I'm going to get my act together. I'm going to get my life together. See, I don't need him. He's crazy, you know. He always swung first, which is not true. But I'm going to get rid of him, and I'm going to get my act together. And I don't know how you try to get your act together, but I buy an outfit, you know. Because you got to get it working, you know what I mean? I got to get ready for the next one. And I got me an outfit, and I was looking right, and all hell broke loose in my life. Just fell like a ski jump. A few stories before I sober up behind this podium. I was one time I was drinking and driving in San Antonio on the freeway, and long story short, I drove my car directly into an on-duty ambulance. They don't think that's cute. But I'm full of fear. It's me against the world. I feel like I don't measure up, and the only way I know how to handle feelings like that is I like to act real tough. So I pulled over on the side of the road. The EMT comes up to my window and knocks on my window. This is me without you, Alcoholics Anonymous. I rolled down my window, and I said, what? He said, ma'am, do you realize you just hit an on-duty ambulance? I said, yeah, I know. What? Like, I can't act tough in the car. I get out of my car, and I'm screaming at this guy. Now, mind you, I hit him, but I'm not going to let it go. They call the police. I go to jail one more time on hitting a public vehicle. Gradually, things get worse. I used to have a little bit of an anger problem, right? Shocking, I know. I would work at the club, and, you know, guys would say these really disrespectful things to me. And as a woman of dignity, I felt like I needed to let them know I didn't appreciate that. Didn't appreciate it. So they would say stuff to me, and I just might clock them. I might throw a drink on them. You know, I remember my boss coming to me one time, and he said, you know, Stacy, that's not what they called me back then. He said, you know, Stacy, people come here to forget about their problems. I'm just like, okay, I'm not picking up what you're putting down. Where are we going with this? You know, so they started finding this relationship between how much I drank and that I would act up, and so they banned me from drinking at the club, which was terrible. I mean, I know that's wrong. You know, I was nowhere near Al-Anon, but I knew that you couldn't take an alcohol away from an alcoholic without a sufficient substitute. And I proceeded to tell them that. I said, you can't expect me to do this and not drink. I can't do this and not have anything. Well, they banned me from drinking for 6 months. So I started finding some of those outside issues. Now, again, this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in singleness of purpose and show my respect for the program of recovery that I am a member of. But I will tell you that if you put pills in my hand, I don't ask stupid questions like, oh, what's this going to do to you and stuff like that. You know, I'm a simple kind of girl. I don't like to complicate things. So they put these pills in my hand, and I took them. And I just remember telling my boss, I got to go. Room started spinning. I knew, I got to go. I left the club that night. That's all I remember. I woke up in University Hospital. That's our county hospital with people standing over me, nurses and doctors. They got surgical masks on. I know the night did not go my way. And I'm asking them, I said, please tell me, did I hurt somebody? Did anybody get hurt? What happened? Please tell me something. And they won't tell me anything. All they're telling me is that the police are outside waiting for me and I need to check in with them when I leave. Now, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard, just so we're clear. So I said, right, okay, well, I'll be right there to talk to him. And I left. So at this point in my story, I'm on the run. Gradually, things get worse. I'm going in and out of jails at this point. I'm going in and out of institutions. Sometimes I'm going into these institutions because I'm drinking too much, but most of the time it's because I'm not drinking at all. What is wrong with me? What's wrong with me? It's getting to a point where I'm checking in my weapon, and I'm turning myself in voluntarily, and I'm telling them that I am not safe. The state deemed it necessary to put me on medication where I would no longer be a danger to myself or anyone else in society. They're telling me that this medication is going to make me okay. It's not making anything better. And I don't know if you've ever been on those kind of medications, but the type of meds that they put me on, you know, I'd be I'd be drinking alcohol, I'd be taking these medications and watching TV, and I wake up and all of a sudden I got Cheetos on my face. You know, I'm like I'm missing these big gaps of time at this point. You know, things are just getting a little weird. I'm driving to work, I don't know how I got there. You know, I don't even know if I'm adequately dressed, which didn't matter in my line of work, but you get the point. It's just getting dark out there, you know, and I'm not showering. I'm not changing my clothes. I wore the same pink jumpsuit for like a month, and I thought I looked like J-Lo. I didn't. You know, I gained a lot of weight. I gained about 60 pounds from drinking and just eating and just not getting off the couch, and I'm not showering, and, you know, I wasn't wearing clean underwear. Back then, I just flipped them inside out, okay? So, laughter is identification. So, you know, things are getting bad, and at this point, I'm unemployable for the kind of work I do, which to me is just kind of the lowest of the low. You know, you can't do that for a living. So I do what somebody like me does. When I get scared, I take another hostage. Now, I'm not proud of this. I had a friend who liked me. I don't know what was going on in his poor life, that he thought a girl that wore the same jumpsuit for 1 month was a little bit of all right. But that's what was up, and I set the deal up. I said, look, you know, you like me. I think I can like you. I will move in with you, and you will take care of me, and I will be good. At this point, I'm just grabbing onto straws, you know. And it ended one night. He came home, and he found me, and I wasn't breathing. He called EMS, and I had to get rushed to University Hospital one more time, dead on arrival. This is not the worst drunk I've ever had. I heard that where I got sober. They said, remember your worst drunk. You know, remember your last drunk, or it's not your last one. This is not the worst drunk I've ever had, okay? And it wasn't my last either, but it was not the worst drunk I ever had. You know, consequences mean nothing to a girl like me. It says in our book, to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. See, it's always scary the first time you have to do something. The first time they arrest you, it is a little frightening. The second and third time, I'm cursing him all the way down to county, you know, because my rights have been violated. It's always demoralizing the first time they put you in the institution. The second and the third and the several times on, you know, I'm there on the first day. I've got my shoelaces off. I got my belt off, and I'm looking for a date. Because that's how I roll. You know, I always find God's will in the state hospital. I know you do, too. You know, it's a slippery slope. And the reason I stay in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes is because I remember what I was doing before I came to you, and I know that will be easier the second time. And sometimes for that reason, I stay with you. Incomprehensible demoralization. I lived there one day at a time. I woke up in University Hospital. MHMR was standing there. Now, y'all don't know who that is, but they're a state-run organization that if ever you have to get involuntarily committed to an institution, they send an assessor out there to ask you some questions, and they get a judge to sign the paperwork, and you're going. They're not asking. You're just going. And this time, they were trying to commit me on a suicide attempt. Now, guys, I had not tried to kill myself. I just drank too much. And I took a little bit too much of those pills that they were prescribing, but that's a whole nother issue. You know, when you feel bad, you just got to treat that, right? So, you know, I'm just explaining to this lady, I'm like, look, I was not trying to kill myself. I was just trying to feel better. You know, can you just leave me alone? See, the book talks about a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. In the beginning of my drinking, I was getting that sense of ease and comfort. But towards the end of my drinking, I was restless, irritable, discontent, and drunk. You know, and it's a horrible place to be when your only solution stops working. It's like you're so drunk you can't get up off the floor, but your mind is as clear as a bell. You know, and I can't wipe away the looks on their faces anymore. I can't drink away the pain. I'm drunk as you know what, and my mind is still talking to me. Why won't that stop? You know, why won't that shut off? And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they tell me, if it has stopped working, you have crossed that invisible line. You are either going to work a spiritual program of action or you are going to find a gun in the pawn shop. The only alternatives for people like me, you know. The disease of alcoholism is progressive and it has everything to do with the internal condition that I suffer from. When you take alcohol away from me like they did at that club, the only thing I'm left with is restless, irritable discontent. Someone is stepping on the hose of the oxygen hose to my soul. I can't breathe. I can't be a part of you. I know how to fly, but I cannot walk. And the only thing that relieves that is to take a drink. So this lady's talking to me, and I'm yelling at her, and I'm telling her I'm just trying to feel better, and I look to the right, and my father is standing there. Now, I did the best I could at leading a double life of trying to keep them out of the loop, of only coming home on the holidays so that they thought everything was going okay in my life, but this time I was caught. Now, my dad is on the board of that hospital, and I need to tell you that I was not the one that made that phone call. And I don't know who did. About the worst day of my life, just looking at my father and saying to him over and over again how sorry I was. How badly I didn't want him to see me like that. And he said to me, he says, "Stacy, I'm sorry because I can't help you." And I would love to tell you that that's the last drink I ever had. That the shame and the guilt and the remorse and the horror of being there and having my parents see me like that. All organs shut down. I mean, I'm completely dependent on all these machines to keep me going. I'm a mess. And I haven't showered and I haven't cut my nails and I've got dirt. And I mean, my hair's matted to my face. And it's not because I've been in the hospital for several days. I just got there. I would love to tell you that the pain of that memory was enough to keep me sober. But that poor guy that I was dating, I called him and I had him bring me booze to the hospital every night because I could not do it. I'm a product of an intervention, but not like the ones you see on TV. My mother had been going to Al-Anon. If you are in this room and you are in Al-Anon, I need to tell you that I love you and thank you. I don't believe my mom could have done what she did if it wasn't for you and the spirit of your fellowship with her. My mom walked into my hospital room and she said, "You get some help or we're prepared to walk away from you." And I believed her. April 25th of 2003, I was driven to a treatment center in the Hill Country. Now, the treatment center did their job. They separated me from alcohol for the last time. If you're anything like me, things aren't getting any better. I was going crazy. I just knew they were going to institutionalize me at any point. I was still seeing things. I was still hearing things. Things were not going well in my life. But they started talking to me about alcoholism. Not the way you do, but they opened a door for me, and the door that they opened was a door in my mind. They said, "For an alcoholic of your type, the only solution is Alcoholics Anonymous. When you get out of treatment, don't unpack, don't go on vacation, don't go get you another boyfriend." That's okay, I had four of them. Treatment center was full of them. They said, "Go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and start working the steps with a sponsor because clearly your life depends on it." Now, they also suggested that I go to a halfway house. Now, that's not a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, but when you have nowhere to live, that's where you go. I had nothing to show for it. I had a six-figure income. Everything that I owned could fit in a very small suitcase. I had nothing. Nothing when I sobered up. No life to return to. So I moved into this halfway house. It was a strange experience. They taught me how to mop. It's just bizarre. You know, they put the mop in my hand, and they said to put some soap and some water on it, and they said, you know, move the mop to the left, right, move it back to the right, you know. I'm up there mopping in stiletto heels. I'm like, this is crazy. I can't do this. I just can't. I'm sorry. But I do know how to mop today. I showed up to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first night out of treatment, my first home group was the world-famous 2211 group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Kerrville, Texas, where they just loved me. There was an old boy in my home group who got sober out in Houston by the name of Frank F. Him and another member of AA got into a fist fight in the parking lot of an AA meeting over who had the most serenity, you know. Now, see, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I know sometimes we see our members' conduct and we go, "Now, that is a bad example of this program." I need to tell you, I identified with Frank. You know, I appreciated Frank. I was like, "Frank, I got you, man. I understand." It's all I had when I came here, you know. But it was just that way. You know, the woman who became my idol in sobriety is Gail S. from Kerrville, Texas. She got sober in Tyler, Texas. Her and her husband just celebrated 35 years of uninterrupted sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope where you go to meetings, you have heroes. I had the wrong kind of heroes when I sobered up. Gail is my hero, man. Just my hero. Most beautiful woman inside and out. Just glows God, you know? One of those people that when you walk in the room, they make the world a safer place just by being there. And that was my Gail. And I remember she would walk into the room and she would see me and she'd just kind of sashay over to me. And in that sweet little voice of hers, she would say to me, "Baby, let me tell you something." And I would say, "Yes, Miss Gail, what is it?" And she would say, "For God's sake, honey, get your toes done." And then she'd just walk off. See, I need to tell you something, Eleanor. I got my toes done today. And that is a tribute to Gail S., who taught me everything I wanted to know in sobriety, who helped me become a woman of dignity. I always wondered what she had, and I never knew what it was. They say, well, what does she have? Well, I don't know. See, I know what it is today. Gail is as beautiful on the inside as she is on the outside. I always thought if I straightened up the outside that somehow the inside would clean up. That is not my experience. This program is an inside job. My friend Candace M. from L.A. says, if you do not go within, you will go without. This is an inside job, and I almost missed it. And Gail was my idol, and I followed her around. I still do to this day. And everything she tells me to do, I'll do. Because I want to be a woman of integrity, you know, a woman that God made me to be. I met the woman who was to become my sponsor in sobriety. My first sponsor was Annie M. from Kerrville, Texas, who got sober in the suburban group of Austin, Texas. I need to tell you that I am a product of some mean sponsorship. I'm assuming that y'all got some of them out here. If you don't know what that is, Nancy B. from Denton gave me a great definition of a mean sponsor. It's someone who cares more about how what you're doing than how you're feeling. My sponsor didn't care how I felt. She said, I don't care how you feel. What I care about is, do you not want to feel that way anymore? She knew that every bad feeling or every problem I had a solution in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And feelings, for the record, are the worst gauge of how I'm doing. There have been times in my sobriety where you ask me how I'm doing, and I'll say, I'm doing really, really well, mainly because I can put my hand in my pocket and feel my money and tell you how I'm doing. But if you ask my sponsor how I'm doing, she'll say, well, when she outgrows some of this self-centeredness, she's going to help a lot of people. There have been times where I felt really bad in sobriety, where I was hurting, when all hell was breaking loose. And if you asked me how I was doing, I would have said, I'm not doing very well at all. But if you ask my sponsor, she'll tell you she's doing great. She's taking commitments. She's taking phone calls. Anybody that's asking her to sponsor, she's being a part of, and she's being present. The feelings are never right. They always lie to me. If you want to know how I'm doing, watch my feet. Watch my conduct. Call my mother. Call my job and ask them how I'm doing. That's the real measure. The firing line has always been out there. See, when I was new, I could behave in meetings really well. I mean, I'm not saying I did. I'm just saying I could, you know. I could, especially if there was a person of interest in the meeting, you know. I can play that deaconess board real well. But my conduct outside the meeting, you didn't know I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was crazy, you know. So I needed the sponsor that I had. I had a mean sponsor. And Annie, you know, Annie was just mean. That's all there is to it. She's just a mean lady. She used to say things that would hurt my feelings. You know, because I was new, right? And I was still not showering and changing my clothes like I needed to. I was still carrying a lot of weight from the pills I had been on. But when you're new, you get a gift. It's that disease of perception thing. You know, I'll see it however I want to see it. So I just knew. Okay. So I just knew that I had it going on, right? I just knew that every man in my home group was so sad that they got married before I came in. I'll see it however I want to see it, you know. And so I was, Annie had this way of like puncturing my ego, you know. She just had that way of doing it. One time we were in Walmart. You know the aisle with the candles with the saints on them? Okay, y'all know how good they look, right? You know, they got the light around them, and maybe they're holding the heart of Jesus. I was looking at that. I thought, I would look good on one of those saint candles. I mean, you could kind of see it, right? My sponsor didn't miss a beat. She said, yeah, you can be the saint of mental patients and fallen women. I thought, you know what? That's just rude. That's rude. See, I'm going to show her. I'm not going to talk to her. Until the next tragedy happened, I was like, Annie, do you have a minute? I was just kidding when I said all that at Walmart, you know. Can we talk? You know, my sponsor was an amazing woman. I believe that there are a lot of things that we are taught through sponsorship. Yes, it's about the big book and the steps and the traditions, but my sponsor taught me how to live in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe when I can live in here, I will learn how to live out there. Every good thing I've ever been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous was, everything I've been taught, period, has been through sponsorship. I learned how to fill out my first job application sober. I learned how to be on time and watch my language and dress appropriately and show my respect to the people I'm talking to. I learned that in here. I didn't have those things I was a contract worker, okay? I didn't have those kind of skills. You didn't have to behave yourself where I worked. You know, I came in here and had to learn all of those things. And Annie taught me those things one day at a time. Every good thing I've learned, I learned how to take a service commitment and see it all the way through. Because I want to quit the moment you give it to me. You know, it's like, you look at me funny, I quit. I'm not doing this. I'm sure a couple of y'all want to quit the committee this weekend. You know, but I was taught integrity. I was taught an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. Every good thing I've learned here. I don't have any other things out there. I'm not taking anger management or any of that other stuff. I don't know anything about that. All I know is here. All I have is you. You're the only thing that's ever worked. You're the only people that'll let me stay here. I don't want to miss the most important part. Annie opened the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and started taking me through that 12-step process. And as that 12-step process started taking place in my life, what happened to me is what it describes in the back of the book, Spiritual Experience, Appendix 2, where it says the personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism occurred. I believe that that woman who walked in here on April 25th of 03, she will always drink again. I can't be her. I don't want to be her. I'm sick of that life, man. I'm sick of burning myself to the ground. I'm sick of being in places I shouldn't be with people I shouldn't be with, and I was doing that sober. I couldn't do it. I couldn't make the change. Even by myself, I don't know how to make that change take place. I'm the queen of New Year's resolutions. And in 2 weeks, I'm back to being me, and me is not enough. Me can't stay here with you. And yes, I had a problem with the God thing. If you're in here and you have a problem with the God thing, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why they titled that chapter, We Agnostics. Not those agnostics. You know, I mean, they knew us. They knew for a gal like me that grew up in private school. Maybe that's what went wrong. Anyway, for a woman like me that grew up in private school and sat in church every day I was in chapel. How can I reconcile a loving God when I'm living in the gutter? When I'm living on the streets? Who does this? You know, of course I had trouble with the God thing. Now, I wasn't mad at God. I just kind of felt like, you know, I mean, okay, pole, God. I don't know. Seemed like a far jump to me. I'm just saying. Just, you know, my mom is the church lady. My mom wears the suits and she looks like I do right now. But, you know, she's just a very dignified woman. I'm not her. I'm not her. Seemed like a far jump. When I was in the mental institution, when I was 12 years old, I remember when they put me in that place, I called home every single day. I said, please come get me, please come get me, please come get me. I don't belong here. There are really crazy people in this place. I was the youngest kid on the unit. And to be honest, I mean, there were things that happened to a 12-year-old in there that shouldn't have happened. It's just what happens. But I've gone through the inventory on that. But I wanted to go home. And I remember calling my parents and saying, please come get me. I don't want to be here. And after a couple of months, it hit me. They were not coming. And in all fairness to them, they took the direction of a psychiatrist. They wanted their kid to be well. And they trusted the professionals they put me with. And at some point when it hit me that they weren't coming, something just broke inside of me. What I know today is that was my spirit. One night I was in my hospital bed and I was laying there and I was wide awake and I'm telling you this story exactly the way it happened. I saw an angel standing at the foot of my bed. I remember she was very tall. She was completely transparent. She was wearing a blue dress. And when I saw her, I experienced a peace like I've never experienced in my life. And I reached out to touch her and she disappeared. Spiritual experience? You bet. But I made a mistake. I told the psychiatrist about it the next morning, right? Man, they raised my medication through the roof, y'all. I think it was like a week later. They were like, so have you seen any angels? I was like, no. She's gone. I learned something. I didn't tell no more professionals about that. I can tell you about it because you understand. I have had spiritual experience drunk or sober. It is that overwhelming experience like I want to celebrate life. I get it a lot at Carlos Santana concerts. Really made me feel good yesterday when you played my boy. Oh, man, I love me some Carlos. Man, when they shine that orange light on Carlos and he starts blaring that guitar with Black Magic Woman and all the lighters and the cell phones go up now. There is no better time than now. There's no better place than here. I'm like, man, Carlos, I am with you, brother. I feel you, right? It's good. But I still go home and get a six-pack and celebrate. It says in our book that we have to have a profound reaction to a change in our reaction to life. It says I have to have a spiritual awakening. And it is an awakening by every sense of the word. To quote my friend Doug D., when I woke up this morning, I saw the ceiling for the first time. Y'all saw the tent, but I saw the ceiling. Now, it wasn't that the ceiling wasn't there while I was asleep. It was that I became awake to the ceiling. See, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous so far removed from anything spiritual, and you told me if I was willing to take the action that the process would yield the results. As a result of working all 12 steps in my life, what happened to me is I became awake and aware of the presence of a loving God that had been there the whole time. It was that I became awake to it, and I have never been the same since. Now, have I been relieved of selfishness and the burden of self? No. It is sometimes an uphill battle to live in my head and to deal with the constant grasp of humility. And my ego rebuilds all the time, and I fall short. But we have a beautiful 10th step for that. What has happened to me this entire psychic change is that I have never left you. I have loved you since then. Now, I loved Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here, except for the fact it had people. That was a problem. Y'all are better now. I like y'all. Y'all have gotten better since I've been here. You've been better. I like that. But, you know, my sponsor promised me if I was willing to say yes in Alcoholics Anonymous and take any service commitment that I was asked to do, say yes in Alcoholics Anonymous. She promised me that amazing things would happen to me in between meetings, and I'm here to tell you they have. Remember how I told y'all that I lived in that halfway house? Well, when I was about a year sober, I got to run that halfway house. I actually got to start a chain of several women's halfway houses in Kerrville. We only had one where I got sober, and a lot of women went home. We had an 18-bed waiting list. We started several of them that are still working today. Women have a place to live and be sober in Kerrville, Texas, where I'm from. And I got to teach them how to mop, right? I told somebody in a meeting one time, you got to watch out for Texas women, just so we're clear. I told some lady in a meeting, I said, you know, they're not acting right. She said, well, darling, why don't you allow them to be new for 5 minutes? We've tolerated you for 5 years. I said, okay, right. Well, you might be right. So I got to run that halfway house. When I was about 2 years sober, I went and worked in the Kerrville State Hospital. When I was 3 years sober, I got to work in a treatment center. I used to say, all I have to do is work in Bexar County Jail. I'll have worked everywhere I've lived, you know. It's a good life. You know, I don't know how to heal from those memories that are so detrimental and so painful. When I was new and I would have those memories, those flashes of those nights. And the pain that I caused, it used to bring me to my knees, and I felt like I couldn't take a breath. My sponsor kept deferring me back to the third step prayer, which reminds me that my life has a purpose. Every bad thing that has ever happened to me, I've been able to share with another alcoholic and help them to overcome what they're going through. If you are still carrying pain, it's important that you share those stories often, that you help another woman or man escape disaster the way you have. I can tell you any story behind this podium today because they do not own me, thanks to the 9th step of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the real healing took place at the level of my soul when I shared those experiences with someone else. And that's the only way I know how to heal. I've not gone through any other things. It's just what I do. I continue to share and I continue to be present. I get phone calls all the time because I do this. People that go through things in sobriety, and it's a nice thing to be able to do that and to give back. It makes everything worthwhile. And I don't regret anything. I love the life that I've been given, and I love the life I live. I got to meet my biological father in sobriety. I believe that there are things that we will be called to do that you must be tapped into a power greater than yourself in order to be given the power to do the things that you will have to be doing. And that was mine. When I was about 2.5 years sober, I was sitting with my mother at her kitchen table, and she was talking to me, and she said, when are you going to contact Ali? That's my father. Now, see, I had conveniently forgot that throughout my life, my dad sent me letters and he wanted to meet me, but I had already been committed to the institution, so in my mind, his life is better without me in it. It's better that he just doesn't know who I am. So I just would ignore the letters. And so my mom said, when are you going to contact Ali? And I said, you know, I'm fine. I am. I'm good. I got you. You know, I got dad. I mean, I have parents. And I've worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm doing just fine. I don't need him. I'm good. And she said, well, you know, Stacy, that's great. But maybe he needs you. See, I'm too busy thinking about how good I'm doing. I don't think about the fact that sometimes by not contacting people, I'm causing pain. So I talked to my sponsor and I said, okay, so she said, yo, in a minute, you need to call this man. You need to be a part of his life. He might need you. He might need to heal. He doesn't have your tools. You need to do the thing. You need to take the lead. You have a program of action. I said, okay. So I talked to my mom and I said, how am I going to find this man? I don't even know where he is. And she said, I don't know, Stacy, but Dripping Springs is a small town. In 1983, he called from this phone number. Why don't you call them and see if they know him? I said, okay. So I called the phone number and he answered the phone. Now see, I've been telling y'all for years in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've been thrown away by the people who should have loved me the most. And that story is incorrect. I was wrong. So I'm going to tell you the correct story today. My father never moved and he never changed his number for 30 years. When I was 16 years old, he bought a Volkswagen Beetle and he fixed it up in case I ever needed a car. He kept it until I was 22 years old in case I ever came and needed something from him. He wanted me to have that car so I could get around. One of the most spiritual things I've ever been asked in Alcoholics Anonymous is it possible you might be wrong? And I will tell you, it's never felt so good to be wrong in my life. My father and I have a beautiful relationship today. I spent Father's Day with him, and my other dads. I've got several. Don't worry about it. We're not going to get into that. I spent some time with him and just had a beautiful time. And, it's weird to meet your dad at 30 years old, but that's what we did. We had just, we started out from scratch, and I'm still learning things, about him and about my culture and about the things that are just kind of gaps in my life, It's a beautiful life. Now, my mother, I have met her. I get asked about this. Have I ever met my biological mother? Yes, I have. We don't have a relationship. What is important for me to know is that she doesn't have our tools and she has not healed. My mother has a lot of pain about the decision that she made, and I wish she didn't. I really do. I wish she knew what I know, which is it was the most loving thing she ever could have done. But until it seeps in for her, until someone gives her that information other than me, because I've tried, we don't have a relationship. I keep putting my side of the bridge down. Maybe someday we'll have a relationship. But, I've been taught to love her for who she is and who she isn't, because that is what you have done for me. I can certainly love my mom for being where she's at right now. It is what it is, and I trust God with all of that. Couple of stories. Jeez, I got to tell these. When I was 4 years sober, I got caught up in a situation with the opposite sex that I wouldn't care to have advertised. I was in a relationship. I made a lot of decisions based on self. I got into a relationship, and that ended very, very badly and caused me a lot of pain in Alcoholics Anonymous. At 4 years sober, I was already flying around the country and talking to people. And people would come up to me after the conference and they would say to me, "You've really helped me. Thank you for sharing your experience. It changed my life." And I would think to myself, if you pat me on the back one more time, I'm going to die. I was living a double life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not talking to my sponsor anymore about that situation because I just didn't want to hear, "I told you not to do that." So I had stopped talking about it. At this point in my sobriety, I took every service commitment that people would allow me to have. If you had a service commitment, I took yours too, because I was trying to outrun alcoholism. I know that today. All I knew is that when I sat down with another alcoholic, it gave me a little bit of peace. It calmed the madness in my head. But the moment I went home and I locked the door, I could not stand who was home. And it got to a point where I don't know why this is happening anymore. All I know is I'm trying to do Alcoholics Anonymous and it's not working. And I'm thinking to myself, maybe Alcoholics Anonymous only works for 5 years and it quits working. Thank God someone told me, when you're in that kind of pain, when in doubt, go to one more meeting, talk to one more person. So I moved to San Antonio, and I had to get a new sponsor. My sponsor wants me to always have people that have eyes on me, So I got a new sponsor, and this woman, the first thing she asked me to do was to do an inventory. She said, "I want you to get current." And she said something to me, because I could quote the book really well at this point. I can quote the book, I can quote the traditions, I know the page numbers. Wouldn't you love to have me in your home group, right? And so when she sat down with me for the first time, I'm quoting the book, and I'm telling her about all this service I'm doing, and she said, "Wow, you sure know the book really well." And I was like, "Mm-hmm." She said, "And you do a lot of service in Alcoholics Anonymous." I'm like, "Yeah." I'm thinking, boy, isn't she blessed to have me. You know, she needs more people like me to sponsor, right? We could just be a crew. You know, I'm thinking how blessed she is. And she said, yeah, she said, I noticed that you can do a lot of quoting of the big book and you take a lot of service, but you don't live the big book at all. She said, Stacy, my recovery is three-dimensional in my life. If you want to know if I've had a spiritual awakening, you will know by my actions. And I would love that to be your experience as well. She said, would you like me to take you through the work? I said, yes, I would be honored to. Please show me how to live the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And so the first thing she asked me to do is write that inventory. And I wrote the inventory on that relationship, which I had not done prior to that point. I had to do a lot of soul searching. There are a lot of people that would have let me off the hook at this point because he had more time than I did. They would have said, oh, you poor victim, you were 13th step, you poor baby. I'm so glad I didn't meet those people. What I had are people in my life that were willing to ask me why I made decisions based on self. Why, when I had been told not to get in that relationship, that I made alternate choices. When people who were clearly of sound mind were telling me not to do it. And when I started doing the inventory, I had to ask myself those honest spiritual questions like, what do you believe about yourself that you would put yourself in a situation like that? Here's what I came to understand. I could tell any woman in Alcoholics Anonymous who came to me, I could say to you, you are a woman of dignity and grace because you stopped drinking. You put the bottle down. You do not have to earn dignity and grace. You already have it. But I did not feel the same way for myself. I thought, and these are inaudible voices, okay? They're in the back of my head, but I don't always pay attention to them. I thought to myself that because I had lived the way I had lived when I was out there, that I could not celebrate or wear white, if you will. Just didn't think I was eligible for that. And I had to make a deep and effective surrender because I ended up in that relationship because this is the best I can hope for. A gal like me is not allowed to have anything else. That's the best I can do. And I made a deep and effective surrender. And a week later, I'm at a conference, and I was minding my own business. Yeah, right. I was minding my own business, and I met him. He was very tall. He was 6'10". I know. People ask me, why did you date somebody so tall? I believe in abundance. That's all there is to it. He was 6'10". He was from Davenport, Iowa. He's an amazing man. Amazing man. And we talked. You know, he went back to Davenport. I went back to Texas. We talked on the phone. I think that's a great way to start a relationship. Talk. You know, that's foreign to me. It was at the time. And we flew back and forth to see each other, and we fell in love, and we made a decision that we were going to be married, and that was something that had never been on my radar before. But I had surrendered some old ideas, and so I was like, yeah, yeah, I mean, this is it, you know. He was the kindest man. He really was. And so we set our date for August the 21st, 2009. And on December 22nd, 3 days before Christmas, I was out there visiting Ed, and he had a heart attack, and he died. And I tell this story a lot behind the podium because, you know, if you're new, I need to tell you how important it is that you find a God of your understanding, because I was out there visiting Ed. It was the last day that I was supposed to be out there when he died. He died at 9:15 in the morning. I had to be on a flight at 3 p.m. that afternoon. It took me almost 10 hours to get home. And I need to tell you, I sat in airports a lot, and the thought to drink never came. There is a time that will come when the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous will not be in my reach. That you won't be there to shield me from the first drink. I need to find a God, and I'm so glad you taught me how to do that, because in all of that time spent in airports, the thought to drink never came. I get email on my phone. I got emails from people in Alcoholics Anonymous who said, hang in there. We're praying for you. Just get home. People I've never met. Thank you. How do you pay that back? I showed up finally got to the airport. It's about 11:30 at night, and that mean sponsor was waiting for me at the airport. And she took me back to Kerrville so I could get my mind around everything. Ugh. So y'all like miracles. I'm going to tell you a miracle story. When I was out there visiting Ed, and for the record, for those of you who knew him, his last talk was in Texas. He spoke in Texoma, Texas, and I drove up there to see him and drove him back to San Antonio and spent some time with him before he flew out, and he gave me an iPod for Christmas. So when I made that trip out to see him, that last trip in December, I would have some music to listen to, and I downloaded a bunch of music on my iPod, and when I got there, I asked him to plug it into his computer so that you know, it would charge, and he lost all my music. That's not the miracle. He accidentally downloaded some of his talks. And I said to him, I said, honey, you know, I have all your talks. I don't need any more of your talks. We laughed about it. Well, he died that Monday. And when I got on the plane at 3 o'clock that afternoon, I put the earphones in my ears. The talk that was on that iPod was his workshop on grief and forgiveness. Isn't God amazing? I listened to his voice all the way home. It's funny, I haven't cried about this for a long time. I always think, well, it healed. No. Oh, good. He taught me on that iPod how to say goodbye to him. There was another talk on that iPod. It was the first time I ever heard him talk about me behind the podium. It was Surrender at Blue Licks in Kentucky. And he said, he spent some time with some of you guys, and he said, if I died tomorrow or if Stacy died, I would die knowing that she loved me and I loved her. That is Alcoholics Anonymous in its best work. When he died, there were no loose ends. I knew that he loved me. He knew I loved him. Alcoholics Anonymous, you gave me that. You gave me an inventory to do on my past sex relations where I wasn't going to hold him accountable for anything I thought my dad did to me or what some man did to me. We started out every day as if it was brand new. I'll be forever grateful that I met him. He has changed my life in a profound way. And many other people, I know. And if ever you want some stories about him, you can talk to me and I'd be happy to tell them to you. I've got some great ones. One of his greatest fears is that he would die alone. He was so afraid because he lived in Davenport. He said, I live in this place where I may die alone and they would never find me. I'm happy to report that did not happen. I was there when he took his last breath. Alcoholics Anonymous, you've given me so many gifts. I can never repay what you've given me. And I'll tell you, I've not been institutionalized for over 13 years. Okay, so I've not been arrested in about 12 and a half. Remember I told y'all that I didn't check in with the police that night? Well, oh, that's the good thing about the state of Texas. You don't ask them what you can do to make it right. They'll just come tell you. They're good for that. I got a call and they said, we know where you are. Come turn yourself in or we'll come get you. I went to my home group and I said, you know, I feel like I'm sober now. I shouldn't have to go to jail. Y'all didn't write any letters for me. Y'all didn't go to court. Y'all taught me how to start meetings in jail. And that's what we do here. You know, I was taught, if you want victory over alcohol, you have to clean up the wreckage of the past. So I turned myself in. I was looking at a 5 to 10 year sentence. They told me to be prepared to do some time because of some issues that were going on politically in San Antonio. They said they're not going to let you off the hook. Be prepared. So I was listening to a lot of Tupac back then. And I still do. Yeah, I still do. Okay. So got myself through that, you know. It turned out they put me on a deferred adjudication probation where if I did anything wrong, if I got arrested, I was going to do the whole 5 year sentence. I never did any of that time. I just got off probation. It was no big deal. I was just doing AA. That's it. You just do AA, and you just don't. It turns out you don't get arrested. You don't curse anybody out. You don't get arrested. It's amazing. It's just amazing. So, one more story I have to tell you because I believe it's important. It's highly instrumental in what I have to say today. But, you know, I had some old ideas. Eddie used to say, if you've thought it before, it's an old idea, and I had one of those. What I believed is I was not college material. I've been kicked out of several universities, okay? When I was drinking, it turns out when you're drunk and you don't show up, they just kick you out. So I've been kicked out of several universities. I had an equivalent to a sixth grade education, and I knew I was not college material. My stepfather, who only knew me and my disease, at 2.5 years sober, came to me and he said, look, I think you're a smart kid, you know, you're working at the state hospital, but I think you could get an education. I want you to do something for me. I want you to go to a college, apply for that college, get as many scholarships as you can, and I'll pay for the rest. And I said, okay, yeah, sure. Because I'm thinking, you know, I've been kicked out of several universities. I don't think I'm on the dean's prospect list, right? And scholarships, not so much. So I showed up to Shriner University in Kerrville, Texas, in some torn jeans and a T-shirt. I said, I want to apply for this college. They gave me the application. They said, take it home, type it, have someone edit it, make it look really nice and neat. I said, well, that's not going to be necessary. So I filled it out real quick with a pen, and I just gave it to them, and I gave them the money for the application, and I said, do you need anything else? They said, we need transcripts from any colleges you've been to. I said, all of them? She said, yes. I said, even if I went there for 2 years and I got no credit? She said, yes. I said, fine. So I called all the colleges. I got my transcripts sent. One day I was at the state hospital working, and I got a call from the admissions office, and they said to me, we need you to come down and sign some paperwork. And I said, why? You know, because I'm thinking, like, I know about affirmative action and all that craziness. Like, do not make me sign something that says that I'm not going to sue you because I'm brown. I don't have time for that. It's ridiculous. I don't want to sign any. I know why you're not going to accept me, and we're clear, and I'm fine. Don't make me waste my gas. So I said, why do I need to come down there? And they said, well, here's the thing. We got your transcripts, all of them. They said, we've never seen anything like this. You have 10 A's, 2 B's, 9 D's, 11 F's, and 10 W's, because that's high roll. She said, your D's and your F's don't transfer. You have a 3.83 GPA. And you're eligible for the presidential scholarship. I said, so what I hear you saying is you're thinking about accepting me to your school. They said, we don't give scholarships. People aren't coming in the fall. So I took the day off, and I ran to the admissions office, and I could not get out of the car. I don't know how to let life be good. I don't know how to accept the abundance that God has for me. I am clear. I know the score. I have a sixth grade education. This is not something I am capable of. I'm wasting a lot of people's time and money. So I said to God, I appreciate this opportunity, but I cannot take it. You need to give it to someone else. I have hurt all your children. I've broken all your commandments. I am not worthy of this opportunity. Thank you very much. I'm driving away. And I heard a voice in my head, but it was not between my ears, and it said, I am not doing this for you. So I went in there and I signed the paperwork because I believed maybe one day I'd be behind a group of people, in front of a group of people, and say, if you have an old idea, you might be wrong. I signed the paperwork on that day, and what a journey it's been. In 2007, I graduated with my bachelor's degree. And in 2010, I walked the stage again with my master's. May of 2015, I successfully defended my dissertation, and I graduated. I am now Dr. Speedlin. They used to say to me, you don't get to where I am today from where I was on human power. If you doubt the power of God, just look at me. If it can happen for me, if I can get through school, anybody can. Now, I'm not saying everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous needs to go to school, but I will tell you that if you have an old idea, you might be wrong. I told Tom, I said, Tom, I can't do this. I can't go to school. And he said to me, Stacy, when it's God's will, the walls come down. And I knew that Tom had become the warden of the penitentiary. He used to be an inmate. And I believed that if that could happen for him, it could happen for me. I'll tell you that college is a little strange. You don't know what you don't know until you sort of crash into it. I'm in this doctoral program. Now, they got 100 applications. They narrowed it down to 20, and they accepted 8 for the year. I was one of the 8. They keep talking about this thing, right? I'm a researcher now. I have a research degree. I'm supposed to be researching. I do, but, you know, they keep talking about the slope of the line. I don't know what that is. Like, I don't know. They didn't talk about that in the Challenger program, okay? I don't have any algebra or what's it called? Trigonometry, whatever it is. I didn't go to that, okay? We talked about the Crips and the Bloods. That's all I know. I know a lot about gang activity and pregnancy, but I don't know anything else. That's what they taught me in high school. So, you know, I just didn't know. I Googled it. And I did school like I did Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you just kind of go till someone kicks you out, and we don't kick you out here, so. You know, you show up on time, you read the book, and you sit up front. That's how I did school, and I made it. I graduated in under 2.5 years, one of the fastest graduates with a PhD. It's crazy. So I got called one day from the school when I graduated. They said, what are you doing this fall? I said, well, you know, I'm just working. I work for the Mental Health Authority of Bexar County, by the way. I work for MHMR. I'm so embarrassed. I work for the place that used to screen me. Work for the team that used to screen me. It's kind of nice. They don't remember me, but we're not going to say nothing, right? They're better left in the dark, yeah? Okay. So I knew it was me because I saw the faith birth date back then.
Didn't change that till I got sober. So anyway, they said, what are you doing in the fall? I said, well, nothing. Why? They said, well, we need you to teach a class. I said, well, what is the class? They said, it's crisis. I said, why, yes, I do have some experience with that. I'd be honored to teach for you. So I'm an adjunct professor. I'm working for the Mental Health Authority of Bexar County. Life is constantly moving forward, and I couldn't be more grateful for my life. I believe that all of us will only understand our experiences as we look back in retrospect. But one thing that I am very, very clear on today, in this moment, right here, right now, is that you can be really, really free in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can do it just enough to pick up a chip once a year, or you can be rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. How free do you want to be? You can be really free in this program, but it means that you have to do a lot of things that you don't want to do. It is a continuous program of action. It is a continuous effort to stay here, but it will pay you in dividends. I'm going to close with some song lyrics, and I don't sing, don't worry, I'm not going to sing it to you, I'm not going to sing. Not everybody in the South sings in the choir, just so we're clear. I'm going to close with some song lyrics. I do love rap music, I listen to rap music, love me some hip-hop music. Thank you. Nobody ever does that. I really appreciate you. Just gets all quiet. They're like, oh, well, she had us until now. Love hip-hop music. Now, there is a song by DMX. And I like this song, and I quote these lyrics every time I talk because it describes what my life is like today thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. Describes it precisely. Describes the life you've given me. And it's in the form of a prayer, so I know y'all will appreciate it. And it goes something like this. God, it is you who wakes me up every day. I'm forever grateful for your love. This is how I pray. You let me touch so many people, and it's all for the good. I influenced so many children, I never thought that I would. And I couldn't take credit for the love that they get, because it all comes from you, God. I am just the one that's giving it. And when it seems like the pressure gets to be too much, I take time out and pray and ask that you be my crutch. And when I get going, I'm not looking back for nothing, because I will know where I'm headed. And I'm so tired of the suffering. I stand before you, a weakened version of your reflection, begging for direction, for my soul needs resurrection. I don't deserve what you've given me, but you never took it from me, because I am grateful and I use it and I do not worship money. If what you want from me is to bring your children to you, my regret is only having one life to do it instead of two. Amen. God bless you all. Thank you for my life.